Hello everyone, welcome to Adoption Adventures. Thank you as always for having a listen. I'm really excited today. I've been contacted and been asked if we could have a guest on the show. And this is a first for me. I usually have to chase people to be a guest here, but we are really honoured to have a lovely guest joining us. And I've been doing some sort of reading up on our guest today, and there's some incredible stories that I'm hoping to be able to share. So without further ado, please welcome Michaela. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm nice, very well.
Nice to be on the show. Yeah.
Thank you for being here. Like I say, it was really lovely that it was your publisher got in touch and mm-hmm. said, you know, I think that there's a link here. I'd love to sort of organize for Michaela to come on. It's like, wow, this is amazing. This is really exciting. Michaela, obviously I'm naturally excited, but at the moment our listeners don't know why. So why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and we'll start laying the groundwork of your experiences.
Well, I'm a singer-songwriter, author, and I most recently wrote a book called Star Child, which is my memoir of growing up with my adopted black Ugandan twin, my brother, who okay. was just, we called each other twins. We were pushing a twin pram in Glasgow at a time when it was very unusual to see a black and white child together in a twin pram. And subsequently, tragically, Frankie died at the age of 27 in a house fire. And 18 years after his death, through nothing short of a series of miracles, I guess, and serendipity, synchronicity, I found his biological family in Uganda.
Wow.
18 years after his death, the chances, the probability of that happening were next to none. Because we had very, very little to go on. So the book is kind of covers that whole journey from childhood, from day one when we got Frankie, to me finding the family and then going on to set up the Star Child charity in memory of Frankie in Uganda, building a school for arts in Uganda, and now working on a centre for autism and disabilities in Uganda. So that's a very broad kind of background to the book, but it is just full of, I think it just proves that that's a continuous thread that connects us after somebody's death, and that the bond with Frankie and I was so incredibly strong, as strong as any biological, if not stronger. And my desire to find out about his own biological family was so intense and so strong that it did lead me there. Like I say, 18 years after his death, that was still haunting me. So it's quite an unusual story. And I think it does show people just how much love there and the bond between two children who come from opposite ends of the world or different colours, a black and a white child, and that transracial adoption, just how close the bond can be.
And that's, I mean, that's incredible. And what an introduction. I mean, so if I can, we'll see sort of what I can unpick, and we'll see where we can go. So first of all, were you adopted, or was it just your brother that was adopted?
Just my brother. Just to give you a little bit of backstory, my parents didn't set out to adopt a black child. They had said on the application that they would accept a hard to place child.
Right.
At that time, a child with, maybe with a disability, an older child, or maybe somebody with behavioural issues. And they had said they were prepared to take that on. And the adoption agency got back to them and said, well, we actually have a little black boy here. He's been with us for 13 months now. He is hard to place. Would you consider a black child? Now, if you put it into the context of the time, it was 1968 that we adopted Frankie. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. Wow. We were looking at the civil rights movement, the riots in America. I mean, it was all filtering over here on TV and radio. And so you can imagine that Frankie at that time was particularly hard to place.
Yeah.
So I think my parents had obviously taken a very quiet anti-racism stance at that point and adopted Frankie. And but of course the adoption agency were very concerned that Frankie was the same age as me because we were identical in age. And they thought there'd be territorial issues, and so he came originally as a foster. And there were no territorial issues. We bonded almost like immediately. And that theory was squashed, and then Frankie became legally ours.
Fantastic.
And I got my twin.
I mean, that's beautiful in itself, because like what you've just said, thinking back to the era in which your parents were doing that adoption, they would have been, like you say, they would have been going against the grain on a lot of things. And I'm gonna hasten to add, I'm gonna use the word naive to a lot of those plights because I've not had to live them. So I don't necessarily understand all of those sort of, I'm gonna use the word struggles or difficulties or sort of, I'm quite naive when it comes to racism as well, because I don't consider myself racist, so I struggle to understand racism. I don't understand why the color of a skin changes the way that we feel about someone. I don't get that as a concept.
Neither do I.
So I always try to play it safe, in as much as I don't want to ever sound like I've got privilege or anything like that. I know that I haven't grown up living in that world, but I also know that in the 60s, that would have been a really, really tough thing because, you know, when I went to school back, even when I was at school sort of in the 90s, it was different to see a black child in school. You would notice them, and there would be a noticing of this black child, which is ridiculous. And I'm happy to say I take our son to school, that definitely wasn't the case anymore. But going back to 68, that must have been potentially even a bigger issue.
Well, but I mean, we did suffer from some racism. But I also have to say that we had an incredible amount of love. And people were, I think, more than racism at that particular point, they were really curious because they'd never seen a black child.
Yeah.
So we would go down the street and my mum would say she could literally hardly get 5 feet, but people would be stopping. They would want to touch Frankie. They would goo goo gaga over him. They would pick him up. They would want to hug him, kiss him. And so, you know, and from her point of view, I mean, this was wonderful, unexpected, and she didn't think it would draw that much attention. But at the same time, she'd not long had me.
Okay.
And she was thinking, here I've got, she's a new mum, she's got this little redhead milk bottle white child with freckles that nobody's looking at and paying one bit of blind attention to, and everybody's looking at my black baby. So from my mum's point of view, I think that started to set up a little bit of an issue that sometimes is overlooked. And so the adoption agency were so concerned about other things, but I don't think anybody ever considered the fact that the attention would be so much on this new black child because nobody had seen it before. And even now that we do see it, I think having spoken to some other people that have black children, they do realise that it draws attention.
Yeah.
But I mean, my parents didn't go out on a mission to Africa to bring back a black child or anything. The child had been left here. Yeah. And of course, that story as to why and everything unravels in the book as well. I uncovered a lot of information about that. But it wasn't that they set out to adopt this black child. And I don't think that they were quite ready for the attention that would get. And Frankie, yes, as we got older, there was certainly some racism and, you know, we would be bars we would walk into and people wouldn't want to serve us. And Frankie never looked for trouble, so we would just tend to leave. And, you know, there was many times where I could say, yes, we were definitely faced that ugly face of racism. And like you, I'll never understand for the life of me. what makes people racist, but there are people like that out there. But there are also an incredible amount of people who just adored Frankie, who loved him, who were willing to give opportunities, you know. And when he died, over 800 people came to his funeral.
Oh, wow.
So I really, you know, I hope that the book, it shines a light on racism and transracial adoption, but I hope that it also shows hope and light in amongst an awful lot of darkness that we're seeing right now about this racism issue.
Yeah.
Because there were so many positives as well as yes, there was the negatives, but a lot of it was how Frankie reacted to that. You know, how the family reacted to that as well. It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. And adoption, as I'm sure you're aware, isn't easy. And then you throw in the colour, and at a time when there was really literally no help, especially for my mum. So, you know, that there was a lot of testing behaviour, you know, things that came up just like probably in the majority of adoptions. You know, self-worth, fear of rejection, you know, testing behaviours were all part and parcel of that as well. But we were also dealing with a child who, I mean, for an example, I think, like, when Frankie came, I was 30 months old, so I didn't ever think, Frankie's different from me. I didn't identify with him being black. He was just my brother. I accepted that he was my brother. Children don't, they're not born racist.
No.
They don't look at a child and say, they might have some level of curiosity, but I didn't think Frankie's black and I'm white. But what happened, there was one day, we were in the bathtub together, and I'm telling this story because it's an extremely telling story. Frankie, we were off in bath together, and one day he turned around to my mum and said to her, we were about five, if I scrub really hard, will I become white like Michaela?
Wow.
And even then, at 5 years of age, I remember that in that moment, and I remember thinking, why does my brother want to change the colour of his skin? And I remember saying, I want to scrub my freckles off because I didn't like my freckles.
Yeah.
And my mum basically then saying, talking about the difference in our melanin in the skin and trying to explain in our 5-year-old why we were different. And that Frankie had this African family who had been his first family. And, you know, his biological family, she explaining that to a child. And I became super curious about who Frankie's family were. I was like, oh, I want to know all about Frankie's family. I want to know all about Africa. I wanted to know where my brother came from. And Frankie didn't want to know.
Really?
As far as he was concerned, he was white. He belonged to the Scottish family. He was so oddly incurious about his family.
Yeah.
And yet I was the one left with all this curiosity.
Yeah.
But then I realized when we were about 10, my father sat down with us both because we were always included in the conversations about anything like that. And he produced this folder and he said to Frankie, you know, that this folder contains some information about your biological family in Africa. Would you like to know anything about them? We don't want you to think that we're hiding anything from you. We're 10 by this point. So is there anything you'd like to know? We'll try our best. And he explained that the adoption had, a lot of adoptions were cloaked in secrecy, but my father was prepared to try and find out any more information that they had. And I could tell that Frankie, his leg was shaking and he was close to tears and he was not happy. And he basically said, you know, I don't want to know anything about Africa. You're my family.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't want to know me. I don't want to know them. You know, and he was so defensive.
Yeah.
And my dad, having been adopted himself, he just closed the folder and he said, that's absolutely fine, Frankie. Just know that if ever you change your mind and there comes a time you want to know anything, we're not hiding anything. It's all here for you.
I mean, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Obviously your dad being adopted would have helped, but you're now talking sort of 78. We're only now starting to get really good at telling our children the stories. So at that stage, being so open about it is incredible. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think sometimes it's the elephant in the room talk about it enough.
Yeah.
You know, and the child is definitely, even although Frankie was being defensive, I think, you know, he would still have that primal wound and the connection would be there.
Yeah.
You know, that's you know, and it took him many, many years to realize that. And that's another reason why I took up that pilgrimage, if you like, after his death, because just before his death, he started to become interested in his family. But until that point, he remained oddly incurious. And I think that with his 10-year-old sensitivities, I think perhaps maybe in his mind, he thought, maybe if I find the family, they're going to send me back to Africa. And I don't want to leave. I love my family and I identify with Scotland. And he would have been maybe terrified internally that could happen, that he could be sent back.
Mm.
And I discovered much later that Frankie had also been previously fostered and then given back because a family had, the parents of the adoptee, adoptive parents, their parents had said, if you adopt that black child, we'll disown you.
Crikey.
So Frankie had been then given back into the system. So no wonder he was a hard to place child.
And
I really do believe that even although these things might not be spoken about and the adoption agency hid all of that, that it resonates at a very subconscious level. The child is aware of it. These things are extremely primal.
Yeah.
And you know, when the child is taken away from its at birth, I believe that there is a severing somewhere. Part of the soul is left there.
Mm.
You know, and there's a kind of, this is a disconnect.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's always going to be there. And that longing, whether it comes out as anger, or you know, sadness, whatever, but there is that deep seated primal wound of that severance of the child from the mother. And I think that Frankie carried that. I think that my father carried it, and I think that my ex-husband, who was also adopted, carried that wound with them. But with Frankie, you had the added thing of the family being in a continent and a country so far away that he was so far removed from.
Might have been a struggle with his identity of, well, where do I fit? What my, you know, we've got the situation with little dude whereby we're not a million miles away from his birth family. So there is a possibility, however slim, that we could bump into his mum. Yeah. Whereas with Frankie, it would have been a case of, well, that's not going to happen. And
no, it's not. But it's funny you should say that, because strangely enough, as a child, this is the way my mind worked. And this is why I think it's really interesting to maybe explore. Sometimes a sibling relationship is not always brought out when people are talking about adoption. But for me, I remember every time I saw a black woman, I thought, I wonder if that's Frankie's mum.
Really? So you were really curious about it, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. Frankie was, it was like there was a biological connection. It was as if we were twins. But I was the one that was freer to think about where he was coming from.
Yeah.
And he wasn't able to express that because he had the emotional baggage, if you like, the emotional trauma of the separation that he had. And, you know, I didn't have that. So therefore, I could explore that a bit easier in my imagination, but I knew better than to discuss it with Frankie because it was like a taboo.
Mm.
It's like you say, the elephant in the room thing I was saying about, you know, it's like, well, let's not go there. Let's not discuss Frankie's adoption because Frankie doesn't want to talk about it.
Mm.
We've tried and he doesn't want to talk about it. So we back off and I'm left as a child with this huge imagination, which I've always had anyway, which is why I like to write.
Yep. But,
and I start imagining who Frankie's mum is.
Mm.
So I'm thinking maybe they just told us that Frankie's mum was in Africa. Maybe that black lady there is Frankie's mum.
Yeah.
It's mad, funny, isn't it?
It's mad. Like we talk a lot about how our children will sometimes come from a shame base, and they will also have split loyalty. So they'll have this fear of, if I say I miss my mum, does that mean that I no longer love my adoptive mum?
And I
think, pulling on what you just said there, I think is interesting, because you did have the freedom to say, I would like to know more, because actually I don't have a split loyalty here. All of my loyalty is to my family, to my brother. So no one can ever question that I want to be somewhere else. Instead, you can just be free to ask those sort of questions, which is fascinating, isn't it?
But yet I couldn't unlock that folder till my family had died. Because it was like, how can I explain it? Like, it was Frankie's to open.
Yes. Yeah.
So I had a really hard time when my parents both died, and I inherited the paperwork, and there in front of me was the folder that was there when I was 10. And I was always anxious to find that folder and open it. But nobody ever said to me, Michaela, would you like to know?
Yes.
And should they? That raises an important question. Should they or should they not? I don't even know. But I do believe that there was some kind of... you know, I don't know. I think the curiosity was set up for me in the bathtub that day, you know, and the itch needed scratched. And when I was faced with the folder, I think I was as curious as Frankie would have been. And I was very nervous, and I wanted there to be something good in there. I wanted them to be good people. I wanted, you know, sometimes the sugarcoat, the reality of adoptions, and, you know, your mum gave you up. Because she loved you, and of course that sets up its whole bunch of problems itself, because then the child has got issues about abandonment, and that, does that mean you love me? I mean, abandoned fear, I mean, all these, we tell these children that they were given up because it was the best thing, because their mum loved them. And then, you know, from me being in a relationship with somebody that has been adopted, to me that sets up a whole other set of issues as well.
Yeah.
Because they've got this thing about, if you love me, you'll abandon me.
It's not a fair message.
It's not. So these things all need addressed as well. It's a very, very complicated subject, adoption, and so is transracial adoption. But getting back to the folder, I mean, I just, when I opened it, and then I actually had this woman who had been in my imagination since the bathtub moment when I was 5. And I actually found out her height and her name. And that just set me off on a whole other journey. And, you know, I just couldn't get enough of it. And then it was like a jigsaw trying to piece it all together. And, you know, the whole story of that unravels in the book as well. You know, I started off on the internet trying to find her, and, you know, when the trail went cold in Belfast, I mean, I traveled, this tale goes everywhere.
Really?
I traveled up and down the country and Uganda and everywhere trying to locate them.
Did you say it took you 10 years to locate them?
No, it was 18 years after his death that I found them.
Right.
But from when I started, I would have said about maybe eight years, something like that.
Wow.
But I wrote a fictional book in the midst of all of this, because I couldn't get enough information. So I invented this fictional woman.
Right.
And it was a fictional book that eventually led me to Uganda, because I had a major agent interested in the book who said to me, she read it and said, I cannot believe you've not been to Uganda. I just want to see what you're going to do when you get to Uganda. And I had been trying to get to Uganda for years, and it was delay. And I was beginning to think somebody didn't want me to go, but I just stuck to that dream and the prayer and the meditations that I was doing on the fact that I would eventually get to Uganda. And when I did go, it was as if that trip had been planned my entire life. The synchronicity, the serendipity, the stuff that happened was nothing short of miracles. I keep using that word because there is no other word for it.
Yeah.
And I eventually found his family. So from the moment of opening the folder, it didn't put my curiosity to rest. It opened up Pandora's box. And then I was like, oh my goodness. And then, of course, I knew that Frankie had had this strong drive to, you know, you're talking about that kind of split identity. He started to identify a bit with his African heritage as he got older.
Oh, okay.
And he met a few more people. By that point, there was more, a few more people. And you know, he loved the music, he loved to dance. You know, he became much more attracted to his own culture.
Mm.
And I do believe that he would have gone, he was starting to become curious. And so for me, it was like I kind of took up that baton and or whatever, you know, that and decided that I wanted to try and put the jigsaw together. But that came with a whole set of complex emotions, because I kind of wanted to do it in secret. I wasn't sure whether I would ever be able to tell this woman.
Mm.
Part of me thought she's out there somewhere and maybe wants to know that her son was okay. She left a black child in a white country for reasons unknown to me at that time.
Mm.
And what was the backstory there? What was her story? We had a bit of it in the folder, which again is in the book. We'd had something to go on. And I knew for a fact that she obviously hadn't wanted to give up the child, but I didn't know all of the circumstances and the father and everything else. So it was like putting a whole, you know, jigsaw together. So, yeah, my curiosity just got the better of me, and I went on that journey, and I was terrified, really, that I would find the mother. And okay. Then what was I going to do? Because if I did find her, do I tell her? I mean, yeah. she could have forgotten all about this child.
Mm.
She maybe didn't want to know. She's had another family, all the rest of it.
Mm.
So it was very difficult. But it turned out that, in a sense, the universe took care of all of that. you know, and Janet had died, and which was extremely sad for me to learn that she had died. But there was three brothers.
Oh, okay.
And I ended up overnight inheriting three brothers in Uganda. Well, one is in the States and two are in Uganda. So, you know, it's... And they had a missing piece, because the last aunt who had died had told the brothers that they had a brother somewhere in the UK. That their mum had had this baby and had never forgotten about it, and they didn't believe the story.
Wow.
And so for them there was this whole like, would mum have done that? Is this story true? Is it not true? They needed to find out as much as I needed to find them. They needed me to find them.
Yeah absolutely.
And put the whole piece together for them and learn the truth. So for them, it was 12 years before I arrived that they had discovered that their mum had given up a child.
Wow.
And they didn't believe it. One of the brothers, Paul, in America believed it. But the two brothers in Uganda have said, no, there's no way mum would do that. Mum wouldn't leave a child. Mum wouldn't abandon a child.
And it must have shaken their world as well, because they must have been sitting there going, hold on, that's not the image that we've thought. And I've done quite a lot of work to try and help people to understand that birth families are not evil people. They are not these two-headed monsters. They're not. And it's very easy to just throw away a comment and say, oh, you know, that mum just gave that child up. I don't think any mother, regardless of their situation, gives a child up.
I don't believe so either. I do believe, like I was saying, there's part of their souls are in limbo somewhere when that disconnect happens. The mother and the child, they carry that with them the rest of their lives. And Frankie's mum, Janet, was no exception. And I do think there was partly Janet, you know, we're getting into a more supernal spiritual realm here, but I do believe that Janet, to some degree, wanted me to go there and Frankie and connect the dots for everybody here, you know, because these are big wounds, or you know, and I think that she never forgot about Frankie.
Yeah.
And that was always my feeling, was that she was yearning for her child. But like I say, I didn't know whether it was sugar-coated or not. And I didn't know what I would find in that folder.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, a lot of the history of Uganda was so turbulent, and some of the stuff in the news had been so horrendous. I really didn't know what I was going to be facing. You know, when I opened a folder and what the history of the family would have been, and the circumstances surrounding his adoption. So I think for for a child to trace their family, to take that brave step, it's very, very difficult. You know, because it was hard enough for me as a sibling.
Yeah.
The pain, you know, and the fear of a second rejection, all of these things are so bound up with that.
And you've now sort of formed a connection with Uganda, haven't you? So so it's almost like, I suppose in the most poetic way, your family adopted Frankie in the fullest sense of the world and the words, because he became your brother and Uganda came your home as well, which I think is, that's a poetic circle, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, his legacy is well and truly living on in Uganda, a country he never visited, but I believe he's there. I feel close to Frankie there. I work there. I've got to know the family a bit. I mean, it's very difficult. I'm out there for relatively short periods of time, you know, but I've been out on many, many occasions, and obviously I work there now with vulnerable children and women, and we have many projects in Uganda. And we've built the school for creative arts. So, I mean, it's just, what has happened is miraculous. And the relationship with the boys is continuing, but they do come from different worlds. I mean, it's to try and get to know that family. For me, there is a connection. It's a strange connection because, you know, I can look at Frank. By the way, I should have said that one of his brothers is called Frank. It's the same name.
Okay, wow.
And looks just like him. I mean, in the moment I met him, I speak about it in the book. It was really hard to actually write just the sheer emotion of meeting his brother who looked like him. And, you know, an older version of Frankie, and the power of that and that link. But then you realize that person's not Frankie. There's a void in me that I know I was trying to fill, you know, and those brothers, you know, to sort of replace the loss that I've had. But they couldn't. I mean, they're not Frankie. They grew up in Uganda under very different circumstances. And, you know, their life is so far removed from mine and how Frankie grew up. It's really hard to get them to understand what our life is like here.
Yeah.
And they do see us all as kind of millionaires and having a lot of money. And of course, what I do there, it means that it's accentuated. And of course, it's not true. I struggle to make a living as an artist. You know, it's very, very hard to make money in the field that I'm in. But they just see, you know, I might be doing podcasts or TV or different things, and they assume that, you know, I'm a millionaire.
Yeah.
So it's you know, we've had a few run-ins, and it's difficult. These are very real things, and then of course you've got the all of the emotion that I've bound up with Frankie, and the sense of wanting to really help. I've got a genuine reason to be there, you know. There's a lot of the white saviour stuff going on, and there's a lot of that in the adoption industry, that, you know, and I call it adoption industry because that's what it is. There's a lot of that going on, and a really dark underbelly to adoption in Uganda as well. So it's been a really, to try and come to terms with everything has been quite difficult.
Yeah.
So I felt I needed to really write the book and get the story out there and the message about adoption and the
absolutely
adoption.
Yeah. And you you touched on there, and sort of we talked briefly before sort of we started the podcast. You touched on the sort of the adoption industry and the white saviors and the darker side of things there. Whilst I try to keep a real approach to adoption, I have no qualms about delving into some of the darker subjects and actually bringing that to light. We never considered inter-country adoption. That was never an option in our minds, but I know that it is for some other people. So did you want to just sort of Tell me a bit more about that.
Well, I don't want to judge anybody here. There's different reasons why people might want to adopt transracially. But I do think if they're seriously thinking about going out to a country like Uganda, and I can really only speak about this through my own lens, I think they really do need to ask themselves some really serious questions as to why they want to adopt a colour child in particular. Mm-hmm. If there maybe is children available. I know that it's very complex to adopt in Western society. The unfortunate thing is that in countries like Uganda, there's so much child exploitation going on.
Yeah.
And really the Muzungu, the white man, we have perpetuated a lot of this problem, and children really are a commodity now. And a lot of Ugandans have been bypassed in favour of white people because everybody makes money out of it, basically.
Right.
And, 80% of Ugandan orphans aren't even orphans. Sometimes they've got parents that have had to put them into an orphanage just so that they can get fed, clothed, educated. Crikey. It's a very corrupt society. And you have to ask yourself why there's been such a huge increase, since the 90s, after a civil war epidemic. There was less orphanages then than there are now. It's because it's become an industry. And half of them, I think there's about 500 unlicensed orphanages in Uganda.
Wow.
And, you can get a birth certificate for like $12, and you can pay off a judge, a lawyer, anything. I mean, your adoptions can be expedited really quickly. They've got all these rules in place. They do. And it all reads very, very well on paper. But the reality of it is, and I absolutely know this firsthand, is that if you've got the money and you want to pay the right people, you can basically walk out of there with a child in a few months.
Oh, crikey.
So
that's
you
so
really,
dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's dangerous, and it's feeding in to the corruption and child exploitation. And also people that are gifting to orphanages, you have to be really careful.
Yeah.
Anybody can set that up. They keep the children looking impoverished.
Mm-hmm.
They keep the place looking impoverished so that you're going to keep donating money. The amount of money that passed through one particular place that I was working in when I first went, I mean, I was all, rose-tinted glasses and thought, I really had my eyes opened. And we're suckers. We really are, and they've got us sussed. And, we go out there and there's all these beautiful orphans and we're so, want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I very quickly uncovered a very, very dark side to adoption and sex trafficking of children, all sorts of stuff is going on. And some people, it's unwittingly, they get pulled into the system that they don't realize what they're actually doing. They think that they're doing the best for the child. But there's an awful lot of, and I'm not against transracial adoption. How could I be?
Of course, yeah.
But I really think that people are not doing their homework. First of all, really ask yourself, why do you want a black child? Have you got a bit of a white savior complex going on? I mean, I'm guilty of it. I'm not demeaning this. I mean, I've got it for my personal reasons because of my brother. And I've had to knock it on the head.
Yeah.
But because I've seen the destructive nature of some of that at play. And I don't want to generalize here, but there's an awful lot of missionary work coming over from America.
Right, yeah.
And I mean, frankly, they're creating problems. I'm not interested in listening or getting to the root of the problems and really helping. I mean, if you really wanted to help, your £3,000 or £4,000 that it's going to cost you, or dollars to get there to work at your orphanage or whatever, could be better spent. You could try and reunify families together, keep the child together with its family or at least relatives. Part of the reason, I say, is poverty. That's why they're in the orphanage. Could you not pay for food, for clothing, for uniforms, for an education? If you really want to help the child, or do you want to pull that child out of the country? Because relative wealth does not, wealth or relative wealth does not necessarily mean a happier child.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Yeah. There's more to it, isn't there?
Yeah, it's you know, we could spend 2 hours just dissecting some of the corruption that's going on in that industry.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound negative, because I wouldn't want to put anybody off transracial adoption. Mm. It can be a beautiful thing, but oh my goodness, you know, make sure you're doing it through the proper channels, that you're not being hoodwinked. The lawyers, I mean, they're so corrupt.
Mm.
You know, and I mean, a lot of it is just a fight for survival.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, we're sitting ducks, and we go out there and our own adoption here has got issues. It can take a long time. And so people think, I'll go there and I can pick up a child. You know, I might have to pay 20,000, but hey, I'm going to have a child in a few months. I can understand the attractiveness of it. But also, you know, adoption is tricky enough, but bringing in colour, you know, it's adding another layer of problems, especially with what's happening.
Yes.
You know, right now. But I would never put anybody off doing it. I just want people to really think seriously and make sure you've done your diligence. Check out the home that you're dealing with. Even the, you know, I could get killed for some of the things, but I don't want to point any names. But I mean, there are definitely establishments out there that, you know, quite high up, that are corrupt, that you really need to look at what you're doing and do a background check, make sure that they can prove that that child doesn't have parents.
Yeah.
Because you would be better spending your money or some money trying to reunify that family and keep the families together. Because I've seen it. I've seen people come along, and I know the child had a father that used to visit one of the orphanages, and he was encouraged to basically sell the child.
Yeah.
So I as long as you're going in with your eyes
wide open,
ears wide open,
yeah,
and you do your due diligence on the establishments that you're working with, and really search inside your own heart and soul and pray, whatever it is, you know, meditate, whatever it is you do.
Yeah.
Really, you know, then if it's coming from the right and your heart, then I believe it will work.
Yeah.
It will work. But too many times people are just not seeing the wood for the trees. What they want is what they see.
Yeah.
And they're ignoring the flags, the red flags that are everywhere.
Mm.
And then they get themselves into something that they might later regret.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm saying, basically.
I think it's absolutely right. I think, you know, it's about having your eyes open. It's about educating yourself on about what you're about to do.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really crucial. Still in the UK, you talked about how Frankie was a hard to place child at the time. Still in the UK, children from a black and minority ethnic backgrounds are still on that list of harder to place children. They still wait longer. And I find that really upsetting.
It's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. And again, as much as I am pointing out some of the negatives about going abroad to adopt some of these children, maybe in third world countries, I support transracial adoption. I support intercultural adoption.
Yeah.
I believe it's such a beautiful thing, and I cannot imagine my life. My life has been enriched so much by having had a black brother.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, from the day that Frankie's came into my world, I mean, his death, everything, you know, he's responsible for so much good in my life that, you know, I can't imagine not having had Frankie and this a beautiful black brother, a different colour from me. And I really, really say to people, you know, go for it.
Yeah.
You know, as much as I'm pointing out the negatives about crossing over to a continent like Uganda, I wouldn't ever want to put somebody off adopting a child from a different race.
No. Because, again, providing you're doing your research, providing you're putting your time, effort and energy into it, and you're open, I think, as well, then that's how we all grow and that's how we all do better. Like you said, how Frankie, and I hear that Frankie sort of went on this journey of initially in that when he first started to recognize the difference and thinking, oh, you know, in the bathtub, I wish that I was white. Could I scrub myself to be white? But then later, as he starts making peace with his family, his unit, and then you said, you know, he started to actually enjoy his culture, learn more about being from Uganda. And you think, you know, it's about making sure that those doors are always left open.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think my family did that. But I think that, and my dad wanted to open them, but Frankie closed them. And I think my dad just realized that Frankie has to open that in his own time. There was no point in pushing it. And I think that we need to listen to the child. You know, so many people, they do think, oh, you know, I'll just talk about their African culture. I'll just, you know, and they're maybe pushing something that the child might not want to address at that point. I think it's really good to do that and offer the child the freedom to explore it if they want to explore it.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, going back to that conversation that we had in the living room when we were 10, I wanted to explore it, but Frankie didn't. You know, hey, what about the sibling? You know, could I get to explore Africa?
Did you talk to Frankie about that? Like,
No. I mean, that's the thing. It became this. I could see Frankie was upset. And there was no point. So therefore, were we right or wrong as a family? I don't know. But we pulled back from discussing it because Frankie didn't want to discuss it. But then as he got older, you know, he started to want to discuss it. And he came to it in his own time. There was nothing pushed. We didn't push the African culture onto him. As I think sometimes now there's this kind of push towards, you know, but I think that's up to the child. You know, Frankie was not ready to embrace his African heritage at that point. So my father just said, okay, that's fine, we just leave it alone. If Frankie wants to embrace it, we embrace it. So I think it's just all about that. And I think you need to acknowledge with all adoptions that there is that elephant, and they miss, even if they don't consciously miss the mum, they do. You know, and I'm not neglecting fathers here. I hope you don't think I'm neglecting fathers.
No, not at all.
I just think that there is that huge bond with that woman whose womb you grew inside. And you know that there's a kind of agony that doesn't leave, and it's not always conscious.
Yeah,
like absolutely. A hole that's there, and sometimes it's okay to say to the child, "You miss her."
We do that with our little dude. We open that door and we let him know that, you know, it's okay to want to know more about your mum, to ask questions, to want to see her. All of those things are absolutely fine. And like what your dad did, you know, the door is there. It's you have to decide to open it.
Exactly.
We're not going to block it.
Exactly. And that's all you can do. But adoption is a wonderful thing, but it's not without its challenges.
Absolutely.
And it's good that there's so many more agencies and things in place and support for families. I think certainly in the days before, it was all very much cloaked in secrecy. We couldn't hide Frankie's adoption because he was black. But to be honest, if he was white, the adoption may have been completely hidden because that's what happened then.
Yeah.
And absolutely. So, you know, I think that having that door open and talking openly is a positive thing. Compared to how it was before, and having people like yourself and podcasts and things available, the more information that people have and sharing of their own knowledge is a good thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm very conscientious of time.
It's talking all the way here.
I know. It's
talk all day to you.
it's a subject I get so excited talking about, and I always want to be learning more. So I've learned so much, and I'm sure our listeners are going to be in the same boat as well. So I've got to say a massive thank you for you making the time to see us.
Oh, no problem.
And your
anything I can do in this area, and try and pick up the book if you're interested.
Absolutely. Well, it's now on my wish list for Santa to drop it off to me.
Oh, great!
And it's called Star Child, isn't it?
Star Child, Michaela Foster Marsh, and you can go online to charity.org, or michaelaonline.com, or Michaela Foster Marsh, and you can get more information. And I'm very accessible if anybody does want to reach out. I'll do my best to get back to you.
Perfect.
And hopefully they'll pick up something from the book that might help them on their own journey.
Absolutely.
Or just an interesting story of human interest.
Absolutely. Well, like I say, it's now in my Amazon bucket to sort of get here for Christmas. I'm going to be putting the links to your sites and everything on the episode blurb, and I wondered as well if I could get your permission. Normally our podcast, it starts with a bit of music, ends with a bit of music. I wanted to know if I could get your permission to end with one of your songs.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
Absolutely. That would be lovely.
Lovely. Do you have one that you would like us to play, or shall we just do Dealer's Choice?
I would be nice. You choose. You
okay.
Choose. I don't know. it's really hard. Yeah. I think you choose.
Okay, I will do. But yes, thank you so much. I'll put all of the links, so you'll be able to find Michaela, you'll be able to find Michaela's work with charity and the book as well. It's some incredible stuff there. So anyone that wants to get in touch with Michaela, they can. But again, thank you on behalf of me and all of our listeners for being a guest with us, Michaela.
Oh, thank you, Richard. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Tears I cried, God knows how hard I tried to make this last.